Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good morning. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Jake Jacobs. We are pre-taping this show in late May, getting ready for, with any luck, I'm going to be out of town. And so hopefully you hear this July 7th, and I'm not in the country at that time. Jake was also on our show on May 26th. And it was an interesting show. It was Memory Lane in Atlantic City 30 or 40 years ago. A lot of the stories were fascinating. Some were juvenile. And if you want to hear about Johnson's in an ice bucket, that's the podcast to listen to. So anyway, Jake is back today. Before we start talking to Jake, we got an email from a listener who liked to play $1 blackjack at the Riviera, and now the Riviera is toast. So Richard, where should he go?
I don't know if you can still find $1 blackjack, but you know, if you want to find $3 blackjack. Did the Riviera really have $1? I think it was $3.
Well, he asked for $1. I don't know what the Riviera had recently.
Yeah, I think it might have been $3. But anyway, I don't know anywhere where you could find $1 blackjack. But you can find $3 blackjack, some of the station properties, and you may have to go on midweek downtown, you know, the D, Union Plaza, the various places on Fremont Street. Other than the Golden Nugget, I don't think you'll find it in there. So that's where you want to go, to some of these off. I mean, I don't see how a casino could actually still make money on a $3 blackjack game. Just the cost of having to put a dealer on the game, I don't think the game could turn a profit.
Yeah, players can't be that bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So, $1 you can play on the machines, you know, on the Game King machines. You could find $1 blackjack. Usually the blackjacks pay even money, but, you know.
Well, what's 1.5%?
Yeah.
Okay, good. But you get slot club points. All right. So, we're back with Jake Jacobs. So, you had some big money stories where big monies were won and lost playing blackjack.
Well, actually, it's more the matter of carrying around big money. Because I think one of the shows that we did, you know, last year, I think the story came up about a teammate of mine who was, you know, back-roomed at the Golden Nugget. And they got him in the back room, and they searched him, and they found $7,000 in cash and an alarm clock. And they, you know, they were looking at that, and they looked at the alarm clock, and they wanted to know if it was, you know, going to explode. And he said, no, it's just, you know, it's an alarm clock. And they said, why are you carrying an alarm clock? And he said, because I can't afford a watch. And, you know, this is actually another guy on the same team who believed in total honesty was, you know, talking to a dealer, and he's betting double 500s at the time, and she says, you know, what do you do for a living? And he said, I'm a dishwasher at Noggles, which was actually true. But she thought that was very, very funny, you know.
Yeah.
It must pay well if you can bet double fives, right?
Did the at the Golden Nugget, this is Atlantic City Golden Nugget?
No, this was downtown Vegas. And did they? Mike McNabb of the Griffin Agency was on the case. And he was the personal nemesis of Jim, you know, kept pulling him up everywhere.
Did he have an explanation of how he could have $7,000 in cash and he couldn't afford a wristwatch.
Well, I mean, it was true. They just, they didn't believe whatever he was going to say anyway. But
It was team money.
But on the way here, because over the years, start out and the first time somebody hands you $1,000 and says go play blackjack, and you're like, wow, I've got $1,000, and they're handing you $3,000, and pretty soon it's, I can't leave the house. I don't have $5,000 in my pocket. And who knows? You might find a game. And, and then over the years in Atlantic City, we'd walk down the boardwalk. We used to keep spare chips, which are certainly what I'd call negotiable instruments. I mean, anybody, yes. Just like cash. So we had, purple chips from all the casinos, and we had an attaché case that was usually whoever was managing the play would have that. But then the manager, and I had on occasion to, be the guy with the briefcase, walking down the boardwalk. Well, I almost got mugged on that boardwalk. And we had a big player who actually was jumped, although he got away, on that boardwalk. So you're walking down the boardwalk with, $300,000 in a briefcase.
Why would you need to transport $300,000 at a time?
Well, we kept all of the chips in the briefcase. And this attaché case, it was like the team bankroll. And, on a given play, you'd only be giving out chips from that casino. But we had stockpiled chips from, all the other casinos.
Right, but why would you need to walk with the whole bankroll down the boardwalk?
Maybe this wasn't the most intelligent thing that was ever done, but, yeah. That was kind of the way. That was the attaché case was where it was kept, and that was where it was kept.
So over the years, what you think is a lot of money keeps getting larger, or at least if you're successful. And, I remember one time I was –
So now $300,000 doesn't sound large to you.
it takes me a couple of weeks to make that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was – I guess I can say I was in Hong Kong, and I was working in horse racing. Uh-huh. And we had these – there are these betting shops all over Hong Kong. And we had these satellite offices, and, we would work out of a satellite office and go to one particular, betting shop. And at the end of the night, at the end of the racing day, we would go back to the main office. And to bet on these horses, you have these – you use these terminals, and you have these cash vouchers. They're kind of like ticket in, ticket out. So they're completely negotiable. And I remember walking back to the office one night with a little over $4 million U.S. in my pocket, thinking, these are completely negotiable. I could just jump in a cab and go to the airport and fly out of here with $4 million.
As guys do, as they say, they whip them out and put them on the table and then measure to see who's longest. So on the way here, Munch and I were talking, and that was the point where I whipped mine out and put it on the table and said, yeah, over $10 million.
So, yeah.
I have nothing to add to these stories.
but it leads into a story, a horse racing story that's the, I think, single most amazing story of that genre. A friend of ours years ago was betting on horses, obviously, and there was an exotic bet in, this city that had very little chance of, it was hard to hit because it was so exotic. And so there was a rollover because most weeks people didn't hit it. And the jackpot would, build up. And
sort of like Powerball.
Yeah, but because of the enormous variance, they decided that they just, they weren't going to bet this thing anymore. And it happened that very week there was a record jackpot had built up, and and they did pay if you got close. They, unlike there was horseshoes, hand grenades, and horse racing. Apparently, there was if you got close, you could get a little bit of a payoff, and so they were
lotteries are like that too.
Yeah,
and it really, we're talking lottery kind of money. So they're looking at the potential payoffs, and the projected EV on some of the bets was the biggest they'd ever seen. And they said, it'd be be sin to, you know, not place these bets. The gambling gods would, you know, shun us forever if we didn't, you know, have these and didn't take advantage of them. So they talked about it, and they said, well, what we're going to do is instead of, you know, spreading, you know, all the bets, we'll just take the highest EV bets, you know, a few really, really high EV bets, and we'll bet them. And here was the important part. The track had an arrangement where if the ticket wasn't cashed in 60 days, the money didn't go to the track. It went to charity. So they said, yeah, we'll make the bet. And then, you know, if we get some consolation prize or something, you know, we'll just, you know, we won't cash the ticket and it'll go to charity. So anyway, they, you know, now as it happens, I'm, you know, following the paper and I see word, you know, that there's this record jackpot. And then I see word the next week that, you know, somebody hit. And there was something, I don't want to go into detail, but there was something peculiar about the bet that, you know, told me that it might be my friend. You know, it just, you know, automatically I said, you know, that's a very, very unusual bet. And so, and then time is passing and the paper, you know, says nobody ever cashed that winner. And if it's not cashed in one more week, it goes to charity. And then a week goes by and it's not cashed. And, you know, the papers are, you know, oh, my God, you know, the biggest winner in history. And, you know, nobody cashed it. And one of the competitors was actually emailing around. And he said, I don't understand this. It's got to be so-and-so. But, you know, how can this be? What happened? So a few months go by and Munch actually runs into our friend and says, do you know anything about this? And, you know, so he explained that, yeah, you know, they had actually hit. And then they looked at it and they said, that's a lot of money. But you wouldn't be honest. I mean, we said that, you know, we were going to let it go to charity and it just wouldn't be right not to let it go to charity. Of course, they had 60 days to think about their decision. But at the end of 60 days, they let the ticket lapse. It went to charity. And the ticket was worth $4, and it paid $4 million to $1.
Oh.
Yeah. Actually, when I went over, he had it framed and hanging on his wall, the
so
ticket.
$16 million U.S.?
Yes. Yes.
Ooh. So yeah. Now we went from 300 to 4 million. I have no stories. I have no stories today. Okay.
Well, actually, I'll give you, there is one bigger. I mean, it's kind of, you know, it gets into a different form of gambling, but the late lamented Alan Woods was shorting the NASDAQ. And he was shorting the NASDAQ, and he was shorting the NASDAQ, and he was shorting the NASDAQ.
And this was during the tech bubble, the first tech bubble. Of the late like 1999, 2000.
Yeah, and he finally couldn't stand it, you know, anymore. I mean, he just couldn't hang on, and he had to, you know, cut his losses, and it had cost him $105 million. And 1 week later, the NASDAQ crashed. If he had hung on one more week, he would have made $500 million.
Which, when he died, he left over $1 billion anyway. So it was okay. You know, he did okay.
Yeah, it's easy for us to. It was only $1.5 billion from somebody else's money. That might change my life. Okay, now you spent a lot of time in Korea, gambling. So what happened? Any interesting stories from Korea in gambling?
Yeah, well, actually, I had a couple. Again, they're relating to money over there. The second trip to Korea, I got in on a Thursday night, which was normal, and then played, you know, through a very jet-lagged weekend. And we had this big player, Ray, and he was going back to the States by way of Japan. And so one of the other guys on the team said, okay, you need to go, you know, Monday morning, you need to fly to Japan. Because Walker Hill and the casinos there had the banking powers, and they would allow you to, if you were, you know, a Japanese big player. They'd never do it for an American. But they would, you know, write out some kind of note that would let you carry money out of the country. Otherwise, you were restricted to $5,000. So Ray, as a big player, had the note. So he was going to bring money out of the country to Japan, and then I was supposed to meet him at the airport, collect the money from him, and then go find some way to wire it to Hong Kong, to Alan Woods. So, you know, okay, fine. So I figured since I was only going to be in Japan overnight and then I was going back to Korea, I wouldn't even pack a bag. You know, I just wore a sports coat and, you know, I had a couple of books in my pocket, and that was all my packing. And I get to the airport, and Ray's flight's delayed. And I was a little bit concerned because I'd only met Ray twice, once over the table when I was calling plays for him, and once, you know, we'd gone out for coffee. But I figured, you know, how hard is it to spot a Japanese guy in Narita Airport? So so I'm waiting around, and his flight's delayed, and I buy two more books. So I've, you know, it's a good thing I've got a sports coat. It's got a lot of pockets. So I've got my four books, and I'm reading, and finally the flight lands, and he recognizes me. And he comes out into the waiting area, and he's got a carry-on bag, and he unzips it. And I realize that there's a slight flaw in my plan in that he didn't bring any bag for me, so he's just going to be handing me the cash. And, you know, so he pulls out ¥1,000,000 and ¥1,000,000. And anyway, he's got ¥17,200,000. And so he's...
Which is how much money? How much U.S.?
At that time, let's say it was $130,000. I mean, it's... There have been times where it would have been over 200, and right now it's back to around 130, I think.
Yeah, if his plan was a little bit later, it could have been worth more.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It was going up at the time. But so he pulls all this out, and now I'm like, oh, no, what do I do? So I pulled out all my books, and I start stuffing pockets. And in those days, I actually I was about Munch's size. You know, I weighed like 169. And... by the time I got through, I looked like Santa Claus. You know, I'm just all stuffed up with money. And then Ray says, but what about my $200,000? And I said, well, what $200,000 was that? And he said, well, one of those bundles isn't $1,000,000. It's got an extra $200,000. So, you know, I'm supposed to get that. I said, you know which one? No. So I pull everything back out again, and I'm going through, and I've, you know, just got it on a chair there in the waiting area. I've got the stacks and stacks of money. And Ray, he's looking around, and, you know, he's smiling, and he said, you know, Americans are so interesting. And I said, oh, how's that? You know, as I'm hunting for his money, he says, yeah, well, you know, if it were me, I'd be so worried with all these Yakuza around, but you're just, you know, you've got all this money out here like it was nothing. What Yakuza? So anyway, I found his $200,000, and I stuffed myself up again, and now I'm riding a bus into the darkness, and I picked a hotel at random, and I, you know, so I'm on a bus for about 2 hours, and I get off, and it's pitch black, and, you know, anybody know where the Sunrider Hotel is? And they kind of point down in the dark, and so I get to the hotel, and by now it's about 11 o'clock at night, and the girl behind the desk, when I check in, I said, do you have a shopping bag? And, oh, yeah, and she gets a shopping bag from behind the counter, and she hands it to me, and now she's wondering what I'm going to do with it. But it's my secret. So I go up to the room, and I actually tried to count the money. I mean, you're supposed to count the money, right? But I was, by this point, blind tired. You know, I counted the same three bills about four times, and finally I said, all right.
That makes 12.
Not my problem. So I put all the money in the shopping bag, and I got a bunch of toilet paper and put it on top to further disguise it. And then I put it in the bathtub and drew the shower curtain. And I figured, well, if a hotel thief comes sneaking in, he probably won't look there. And if he does, there's toilet paper on top. So, you know, and then in the morning, of course, I'm carrying it with me to breakfast. And I got done. I checked out and I said, now, I need to wire some money. And I think she thought that I meant change money in retrospect. But she said, oh, you can do that here. Said, really? So I write down the figures on a piece of paper, and she looks at that and freaks out. No, no. I said, yeah, okay, so where's the bank? And so she points back towards, you know, where I got off the bus. So I go back there, and sure enough, there's a bank back there. And I walked in, I walk up to the counter, and this kid's about 23. And he looks, you know, just, you know, oh, I've seen it all. And I said, you know, I'd like to TT money to Hong Kong. Okay. And I said, you know, I wrote down the number. Okay, no problem. You know, what I wanted to send was $15.5 million, and then I wanted to change, you know, the other $1.5 million. I wanted to get 10,000 U.S. in a bundle, and, you know, I'd probably have some leftover yen. So I you know, I said I want to, you know, send this money. Oh, okay. And he said, now, you know, how do you want to send the money? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, like, where's, you know, what kind of money? I said, oh, well, you know, cash. And he said, cashy? And I said, yeah, cash. Cashy? I said, yeah, cash. He said, where cashy? And I said, here, cashy. So I put the shopping bag up on the counter, and I start pulling out my four books, and I put them on the counter, and there he's got an assistant who's about 20, and they're watching me, and they're looking, you know, from Bonsai to Levi's, good book, you know, and I get these books out, and then I start pulling out toilet paper and putting it down on the counter, and they're looking at that like, oh, these Americans, you know, what are they up to? And then I pull out 1,000,000 yen, and the guy looks at that, and I pull out another 1,000,000 yen, and all of a sudden his eyes start to get a little big. And I pull out another 1,000,000 yen, and he goes, and he sucks in breath, and I pull out another 1,000,000 yen, and now he starts to, you know, mildly hyperventilate, and I start pulling out more money, and now he's going, that's a lot of money, that's a lot of money, that's a lot of money, just a minute, just a minute. And he runs off, and he and the kid come back, I mean the younger kid, and you know those, you ever see those oval plastic trays that, you know, you put your money in, they give you your change back in restaurants? Well, they've got... Yeah, they're like little bitty plastic baskets, and they've got two of those, one for each of them, and they come running back, and he's going, just a minute, just a minute, and he's running around in a circle with his helper following him, and they're chasing each other in a circle, and all of a sudden he turns around and starts the other way and bangs like a cartoon, and, you know, and he's going, oh, just a minute, you know, and that's a lot of money, and finally, he, you know, I've got all the money out there, and now he looks at me, he goes, just a minute, and he says, sit there. So I went over and I, you know, great, I've got four books to read. I've got plenty of time. So I sat down and I'm reading.
With all that money just on the counter.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, it's a bank. You know, it's safe. So I go back and I sit down and I'm reading, and maybe 20 minutes go by and he comes up to me and he's got a clipboard. And he said, please, why do you wire money? And I said, why do you want to know? And he says, for emperor. And I said, oh, I said, I wire the money for debt. He said, debt? And I said, right, D-E-B-T. I owe, so I must pay. And he said, oh, and he wrote that down, and he walked off. And so now, you know, a while later, he came back, and they couldn't change. They didn't have dollars. So they wound up, I think I wired the whole 17. And, you know, and that was that. So that was the first time I had wired a lot of money in a, you know, foreign country. But later in Korea, and by the way, a month later we needed the money back in Korea, and Phil had to actually go to Hong Kong and get it and bring it back. But later in Korea, we had this bank that we used all the time, and it wasn't. I mean, I'm not even on the bank account. It was somebody else's bank account, but I had the chop. And they just got used to seeing me, and I'd walk in, and everybody in the bank would stand up, and they'd bow. And I'd go into this, you know, they had kind of a conference room, and I'd go in there, and then they'd have this tea girl that would come in with tea, and, you know, I'd sit there and drink tea, and they had a banker assigned to me, actually a couple of bankers over the, you know, couple of years named Mr. Lee. Each of them was named Mr. Lee, and they were English graduates, that's why they were assigned to me. And they couldn't actually speak English, but, you know, they had a degree in English. So
we should just say a chop in a Korean bank, it's not about your signature. It's about having this little
name
stick. Like a rubber stamp, you know, and it's called a chop. So, yeah, if you have the chop, you have
– I had the chop. And anyway, I go in there the one day, and Mr. Lee comes in, and you know, I write down that I wanted to send $15,000 to Hong Kong. And he goes, which is the symbol over there that, okay, you know, it's big trouble. This is impossible, but I don't know how to tell you, so I'm not going to tell you. And he says, wait, please. And I, you know, again, I had some books with me, and I'm reading, and it took an inordinately long time. And finally, about 2 hours had gone by. And Mr. Lee comes in, and, you know, he's struggling with his English trying to explain what happened. And it seemed that there were three problems. Number one, the bank didn't wire money. They didn't have that right, you know, so they couldn't wire the money for me because it wasn't something they were allowed to do. Number two, you know, even if you were wiring money, there was a limit of $5,000 that you could wire, you know, that an individual could wire. It's $5,000, and I was trying to wire 15. And number three, it was me trying to do it, and foreigners don't have the right to wire money out of Korea. You'd have to be a Korean citizen. So, you know, so these were three problems. But anyway, the 2 hours, the reason it had taken so long was that, you know, he had explained that, you know, it was now done. The money had been wired. And what had happened was Mr. Lee had a cousin, Miss Lee, that worked at a different bank, and this bank had the right to wire money. So Mr. Lee had called in the tea girl, Miss Lee, and had given her the $15,000 and sent her with a note, or maybe he called, you know, over to his cousin's bank. And then the cousin wired the $15,000, $5,000 in her name, $5,000 in his name, and $5,000 in the tea girl's name.
They're all named Mr. Lee.
All named Lee. And then not, you know, well, two of them were related. The tea girl wasn't related. But anyway, yeah, and then came back to tell me that problem solved. And that's the way you like it. You don't want to hear about the problems.
Can you
just
imagine
want somebody who does it.
A banker doing something like that in the United States? It's, I mean, yeah, that's customer service. You know, that reminds me of a story. When I first got to Korea and I had to change money for the first time on the black market, because you get a better exchange rate on the black market. So there was this guy, Marty, who is the character Jake's book, The Battered Butterfly, is based on, Marty Itzkowitz. And Marty takes me to the black market, which is basically down this back alley past all these fish stalls. And we go to this guy's house, and Marty says, you know, what was his name? Lee? Or Kim? Mr. Kim or Mr. Lee?
No, it's Mr. Lee.
Yeah, Mr. Lee. Everybody there is named either Kim, Lee, or Park. So he says, this is the money changer. He'll help you out. So I sit down, and the guy has a safe in his house. And this was a traditional Korean house. There was no furniture. You sit on the floor. And but there was a safe was the only thing in the room other than the kind of mats on the floor. So anyway, I tell him I want to change money. He says, how much? I say, $20,000. He says, okay, give me the money. I give him the money. He very carefully counts out the $20,000 U.S. and turns around, puts it in the safe, closes the door, and says, come back at 7 o'clock. And I was like, oh, no, no, no. Give me my money back. And he's like, no, no, it's okay. I'm like, no, it's not okay. Give me my money back. And he says, it's okay, it's okay. No, no, I want my money back. So he gives me the money back. I said, I'll come back at 7 o'clock. You'll have the money then? And he says, yes, 7 o'clock. I said, okay. So I got my money back, and I leave. Now it was winter, so it's dark, right? And now I have to go down these dark alleys to this guy's house. And the average income at that time in Korea was $200 a month. So here they know I'm coming with $20,000. And I'm walking down this dark alley going, this is really a bad idea. You know, this is really stupid.
Has the potential not to turn out well.
Yeah. But for some reason, I was young and stupid. I decided to go. I went and I continued on and I went to his house and I gave him the $20,000 and he gave me the Korean money and everything was fine. And after then doing business with this guy for 3 years, you know, after that, I realized looking back, I could have just left my money with him and come back at 7 o'clock and he would have had my money and it really would not have been a problem. But yeah, at the time, I certainly was not going to just leave a guy with $20,000.
I had the identical, you know, experience because Daryl had showed me where the apartment was, except that the guy wasn't home, and so Daryl had showed me that that was the wrong apartment, and then I wound up having to go there on my own at night to try to find a guy I had never met with $85,000 in my pocket walking down this, you know, alley that was pitch black, and, yeah, and it was some mama-san had, you know, taken me to this guy's apartment, and, you know, I'm walking in there, and the guy doesn't speak English, and at the time, I didn't know any Korean, and I had never met Marty, but I knew that if it was the right guy, he knew Marty. So that was the first thing I said to him was, you know, me, Marty, Chingu, like, I, Marty, friend. You know, and he's, oh, Mr. Marty, professional gambler. And, but yeah. He later You know, I'd go in, and by now he had opened the Honorable Jesus bookstore, the Yesu Nim Chekbang. And
Honorable Jesus bookstore.
Yeah, and I, you know, and actually I saw on the wall, he had stuff written on the wall, and there was a date, October in 1992, and, you know, this was 1991, and I, you know, how... Why is that date on the wall? What's and he, oh, that's when the world ends. Oh, nice to know. And and sure enough, he wound up, you know, I'm hearing on the news a year later that, you know, Korean cult, they've liquidated all their belongings and, you know, they're waiting for the end of the world. And, yeah, he was gone. But I can remember going in there and buying $70,000 in U.S. dollars. And... you know, I mean, I walk in, okay, I need 70,000 in U.S. dollars, and this guy, you know, pretty soon a motorcycle shows up, and there's, you know, you'd think it was fish and chips. It's wrapped up in newspaper, but no, it's got my money. But I, that particular time, there was a about a 30-ish Korean woman that was in there. Don't know what, you know, what she did, but she was in there, and she was getting 100,000 in U.S. dollars. And that happened to me later after he left. The action moved over to this underwear shop that was in this alley behind the Hamilton Hotel. And I went in there to, you know, do, you know, again, I was getting like 70, 80 grand. And there was, you know, again, there was a woman in front of me. In fact, I think I was getting 90 and she was getting $120,000. You know, and this woman sitting in the back of this little underwear shop gives the woman in front of me 120,000 U.S. dollars, gives me 90,000 U.S. dollars, and, you know, they just, no problem.
Yeah, I mean, money changer is sort of a well-known, respected profession in every neighborhood. So, you know, they can't afford to rip you off because they're, a you know, an established business.
Well, so. No, I mean, they were black market, but it went legit. Now the money changers are all licensed.
Yeah, now.
These guys were unlicensed, but they were, yeah. I mean, they were well-known, and, you know, everybody in the neighborhood knew who to go to.
And. Well, and the other thing is whenever I would go, you know, I would often go there, and there'd be some GI selling him scotch and cartons of cigarettes and cans of Spam. I mean, yeah. You know, they dealt in everything on the
Spam
black
is very popular.
Yeah, yes.
Is I mean, but the... The local criminals also had to know where this place was.
I guess.
Well,
but.
Sure, because actually, you know, in Itaewon, you had a lot of clubs, and they had what they called the picky boys outside the clubs. They were greeters that would try to get you to go inside these Korean clubs, but yeah, they were all low level mobsters, and actually. One time, they had these illegal casinos, and, you know, I was going and playing in these illegal casinos, and the one time, you know, I just, you know, it was too hard to keep your eye on, you know, everything that was going on, so I had, Marty had come in and a couple other guys to, you know, watch the game and make sure that, you know, the dealers weren't cheating, and... This dealer, you know, knew Marty and, you know, was telling him that he couldn't play. And Marty wasn't there to play, but, you know, he got really huffy and he said, well, you know, you can't tell me that I can't play because if I wanted to play, I could play. And, you know, if you tried to stop me, he said, I'd, you know, go to the cops and I wouldn't go to the, you know, Dong police and I wouldn't go to the Goo police. I'd go all the way downtown to, you know, Central Police and I'd take away your rice bowl and your boss's rice bowl and, well... I was in the Club Bavaria the night before I left for
Does this play well in a foreign country? I wouldn't think that would play well at all.
Well, it was Marty. I mean, you know, and so I'm sitting in the Club Bavaria, and that's the night before I was leaving to go to the Philippines with Marty first time, and Tom Casey came in. And all of a sudden, these Korean guys came in, and they went to the back, and it's really dark back there, and somebody, you know, came to Tom and said, you know, they want to talk to you, and Tom goes, and he comes back, and he's shaking, you know, he's, and apparently, you know, he's going, oh, that's the biggest gangster in Itaewon, and Mr. Lee, seriously, that was Mr. Lee, and, although I had a girlfriend at the time who told me, no, he's not the biggest gangster. But anyway, you know, whoever he was a gangster. And he happened to be the owner not only of a nightclub in the neighborhood, but he owned the illegal casino. And he had gotten word that Marty was, you know, threatening him. And so he had, you know, passed the message through Tom, tell Marty that, you know, you're a dead man if you set foot in Itaewon. So the next day, we're on the plane. Oh, by the way, Marty, I've got a message for you. And I told him, and Marty, you know, he's starting to unbuckle his seatbelt. All right, turn this plane around. And I said, you know, Marty, relax. No, no, no. If they think that you're running, you know, then you'll have to run for the rest of your life. Marty, we're going to the Philippines. You can always go back and kill him later. And it turned out, you know, he was in the Philippines about 6 months, and by the time he came back, the guy had gone to jail and got stabbed to death in prison. So...
Now, you mentioned playing in illegal casinos. I would think most of our listeners are going to think, are you out of your mind? How could you go play in an illegal casino in a foreign country?
Well, it was a very, very strange thing. You know, the inimitable Malcolm Sims, you know, his one of the first people to go into one of these. And he went in and, you know, he's playing a four-deck game. And the count at the end of the, you know, when the cut card came out was plus 23. But they do a Berlin shuffle. So
a Berlin shuffle for our listeners was about as simple a shuffle as you could possibly imagine. So yeah. A very, very easy thing to track.
Yeah. In other words, that last deck, the deck that he hadn't gotten to play, got shuffled into itself, and he was able to cut it to the front of the shoe. So he does, and he, you know, pounds the money out there, and at the end of that deck, the count's plus 12. And so Malcolm stands up to his full 6'3", and he said, "You think that I was born yesterday?" And he raises a rumpus, and he made them bring out four new decks, and he examined them carefully. He said, "Now we're playing with these," and they did.
He also demanded they give the money back that he had lost, and they did, which was really amazing.
Yeah, and so now he starts playing again, and at the end of the shoe, you know, he's won like $3,000, and it turns out that they have no money in the cage, not $1. But, you know, Malcolm, you know, insists that, you know, he's going to come back the next day and they'd better have the money, and they did. And that was exactly my experience. I went around to about four of these casinos, and... You know, every casino, I'd go in and I'd play and I'd beat them. In fact, this was the only one that I didn't beat. But the other, you know, the other three, I'd go in and one of them I was in multiple times, you know. And, you know, if I had a big win, they wouldn't have any money in the cage and I'd have to, you know, come back. And eventually this one casino in Oksudong. And, you know, and I was a little worried. I mean, the first time that I got stiffed, I was a little worried about it. And I had an ex-girlfriend, and Ara she had been a distributor for a while for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. When it first cracked the Korean market, she was going around to the clubs and saying, you know, buy American cigarettes. And the Philip Morris people, you know, Marlboro, they kidnapped her and they threatened her. And so then the company assigned this guy, Mr. Go. And Mr. Go, you know, when she first introduced me to him, I got the impression he was a delivery boy. But, you know, later I kind of got more of the story. You know, by now we weren't going together. She was now living with Mr. Go. You know, she said, the guy that ran the casino that owed me the money, she said, "Oh, that's Kim In-ki. You know, I know him." And, you know, she said, "He's a gangster, but he's not a very big gangster." And she said, "You know, Mr. Go is a much bigger gangster. And so why don't you take Mr. Go with you?" And I thought, well, that's not exactly, you know, the direction I was heading here. So I tell you what, I'll go there and I'll see if they have my money tomorrow. If they don't have the money, then I'll bring Mr. Go. But I came in and, you know, here's your money, but please don't play anymore. So at this one casino in Oksudong, you know, it was a good game, and I won about $4,000 in there. Daryl and Art go there, and they wind up losing. I think at first they lost about $11,000, and then they came back, and they just, in a rush, they wound up winning $30,000. So, you know, pay us, and no money in the cage, and, you know, $30,000. So... They stalled him for, you know, several days. And finally, Art had to leave, and so Darryl postponed his flight, and he went. And so he calls me up, and he said, "Okay, I'm going over there to the AmVets, and if I don't call you by 3 o'clock, call the police, and don't call the Dorn police, the Goo police, call the downtown police, like Marty said." So I said, "Okay, fine." So I'm sitting there at Tom Casey's place watching TV, and I know Darryl usually runs late, so it's about 3:05, and I haven't gotten up to call anybody as yet, and the phone rings, hello, and it's Darryl, and he's going, you didn't call yet. And I said, no, Darryl, calm down. And he'd gotten stuck in traffic, so he hadn't gotten there yet. So he finally, I guess he got there, and what had happened was, the day before, he had gone in, and he'd gone on a rampage where he was going into meeting rooms and walking up to strange Korean customers and saying, "Do you know these people won't pay me? They owe me a lot of money, and they won't pay me," and they tore his shirt. And everybody kind of froze, and then they just said, "Come back tomorrow, we'll have your money." So this is the next day. He gets there. They're waiting for him outside with a brown paper bag. And they said, "Count it and leave." And he said, "Well, maybe I should count it in." "No, you count it out here. You're not coming inside." And he counted, and it was $30,000, and yeah.
I played in one of those where I had been warned by Malcolm that when they go to change the cards, they will bring in a shoe with all the little cards in it. So, I play the first shoe. I'm winning a little bit. And they say, "Okay, new cards." And they bring over these four decks, and the girl breaks it in half. She's going to shuffle them. And I go, no, spread the cards. And she looks at me kind of funny. I'm like, "Spread them face up. I want to see the cards." "Okay." She turns the cards over, and the cards are ace, 2, 3, 4, 4, 4, 5, 5, 5, 6. And the boss comes running over. No, wrong cards. Then they did bring in fresh decks. So
yeah, and yeah. I mean, and these places had great rules. They, they're
advantage off the top.
Off the top. But the most dangerous money situation I got into carrying money was. I was coming back from Southeast Asia, heading toward Hong Kong, and I was in the Philippines. And I actually was at the pool, and, the phone rings, and it turns out, that somebody says, "Jake and Marty," and who knows I'm here? Well, it was Alan Woods looking for me, and he was in Manila, and he says,
that Alan shows up everywhere, doesn't he?
He says, "Would you like to see how real Filipinos live?" "Well, yeah, sure." So he comes around the next day. He said, "We're going to go see Anna Marie's mother." And I said, "Now, Woody, I'm bringing you some cash in Hong Kong. And, I don't know how much yet, but I can give you $20,000 today if you want." And he said, "Oh, great. That's great." So I went in the safety box and I give him $20,000. So we get in this taxi and we're driving and the neighborhood's getting worse and worse and worse and worse and still worse. And I mean, and then it's like unbelievable, and we're still driving, and it's still getting worse. And we finally, after about an hour, we stop somewhere. And Alan, is usually oblivious, but he gets out of the taxi and he's looking around. He says, "Anna Marie, are you quite sure this is safe?" And she, "Oh yeah, I come here all the time." And meantime, the cab driver is locking all the doors of his cab, and he goes in a cloud of dust. And we are in this shanty town, and there are about 10,000 people shuffling around like zombies in Day of the Dead. They have nowhere to go, so they're standing there in the noonday Manila sun, and they're just shuffling in place in the dirt. And so we go into this rabbit warren of, corrugated iron and cardboard and, with dripping water. And we wind up back somewhere, and Anna Marie has found a girlfriend, and they've disappeared. And so Alan and I are sitting on these little plastic stools with there was some old fat lady that was sitting there glaring at us. And Alan says, "Oh, my pants are too tight here." And he hands me the envelope with the $20,000. So I put that back in my pocket, and it turned out that we then went to see Anna Marie's family, and they were living in a room that was 6 feet wide by 4 feet deep by 6 feet high. This was her stepfather, her mother, her 15-year-old stepsister, and her baby. There were two shelves on the one wall. That's what the four of them slept on. All their belongings, one bare wire that was run through a drilled hole in the wall with a light bulb hanging off of it. I mean, just inconceivable.
Yeah, so, if you've never been to a third world country and seen real poverty, it is shocking when you actually see how people live.
Yeah, so we come out of this, and we're out with the zombies again looking for transportation. And this kid, he's probably about 15, but he's maybe 6 feet tall, which is, you know, he's looking down on me. And he had absolutely no affect. I mean, I've never seen a human being that had nothing in his face, but until I saw this guy. And he walks up to me, and he looks down at me, and he says, "Give me 100 pesos for whiskey." And he had a gang, you know, with him that were kind of hanging back. And, you know, he was clearly the leader. And if I give him money, you know, the mob is going to be on me. If I don't give him money, his gang is going to be on me. So I said, yeah, okay, 100 pesos, sure. But you have to talk to her. She's my accountant, and she handles my cash disbursements. And he said, "What?" And I said, "Yeah, well, you know, you want 100 pesos, and I want to give you 100 pesos, but I don't actually handle the money myself. My accountant handles the money, so you talk to her. She does the cash disbursements, and you get the 100 pesos from her." "What?" And in the meantime, they've summoned transportation, but it's tricycles, you know, with seats behind them. And I'm getting into this thing, and the driver is about 70 years old, and he can't summon the inertia to move. You know, we're moving about 1 foot every 3 seconds, and this guy is still standing there trying to figure out what I'm talking about. And, you know, he could have easily run up and dragged me out of this thing, but that was how we made our getaway.
For this 70-year-old...
pedicab driver.
Pedicab, almost like a rickshaw, except it was a tricycle.
Yeah,
actually, Munchkin once escaped in a hansom cab in Poland.
Yeah, Daryl and I got out. Yeah, we had some guys after us in Poland, and we were in a town square, and the only way in and out of the town square were these narrow little streets, but they had these guys with horse-drawn carriages, and we jumped into one and said, "Get us out of here," you know.
Yes. Streetcar named Desire.
That's a story for another time, a much longer story. But
all right, we're going to do brief commercials today. We don't know when this is going to be aired for sure, so I can't talk about the specific promotions that's going on. The South Point will still have more than 10,000 gains, returning over 99%. The Palms will likely still have drawings on Friday evening and play for prizes. Don't know what the gift cards will be this month, but there will likely be some. And videopoker.com is still the best place to practice. Lots of games online that you can't get computerized help anywhere else. We thank all three sponsors and appreciate their understanding that we had to tape it early. All right, so you talked about the story for next time. We need 1 5-minute story for this time. What do we got?
Okay, well, probably either the Atlantic City Taxi or the Buried Treasure. Might be able to get both of them in if I'm quick.
Go.
Okay, so Mike Mihalik goes down to the Bahamas, and he is down there playing, and he wins, and he's got $100,000. And, you know, it's hard to carry money in and out of countries, and he knows that somebody will be along. So he goes out, and he buys a shovel, and he rents a car, and he drives out into the countryside, and he digs a hole, and he buries the $100,000 in the ground, and then he draws a treasure map. So now he comes back.
And, X marks the spot.
Yeah, and his friends say, "How did you? You know, how were you able to store the money? Did you get a safety box?" He's, "No, I did better than that. You know, I buried the money." And they said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, but I got a treasure map." So the next person that they send is, you know, that intrepid explorer, Tommy Hyland. And Tommy, you know, goes down there and he's got the treasure map. And so he buys another shovel and he rents a car and he goes driving out in the countryside and, you know, okay, turn left at the third tree and, you know, dig here. And he and lo and behold, the money is actually there. But, you know, what they don't tell you in the pirate movies is that there's some kind of money-eating bacteria in the ground. So all of the money is black and stinks. And it's smelling up the cage when he brings it out at the table. It's reeking. And so anyway, that was the buried treasure story.
Did they eventually able to convert much of it or all of it?
Well, yes, they converted it into the possession of the crown because they nailed Tommy was turned in by a jerk, and they nailed him for playing with a computer. There was no law at the time, but they confiscated the $100,000 and said, the fine for that will be $100,000, and you know, they kept it, and he wound up having to sue.
All right.
So now the taxi story.
Okay.
It's an Atlantic City story, and this guy Bob, who was another part of that Tommy team, he's in a taxi going out to the Philly airport because Atlantic City has only a very tiny airport. And he's got an attaché case with a bunch of cash at his feet. And he's sitting up front with the driver, and they're talking, having a nice chat. And he gets to the airport, and he gets out. He's got his bags, and he's missing one bag. And the taxi has just driven off. So he runs inside, and he gets on the phone. And by the time he gets a hold of the taxi company, the taxi company says, well, you know, the Atlantic City or Philly is out of our radio range. So now he gets another cab, and he said, okay, we've got to chase down this cab, and, you know, I'll pay the tickets. So this guy is zooming along at about 100 miles an hour and gets pulled over by the state troopers. So he says, officer, you know, I've got a lot of money, and, you know, and finally he manages to convince the cop that there's something more interesting than writing a ticket for the cab driver. So they call ahead to the toll booth. Cab's already gotten through. So he gets back to Atlantic City, and they refer him to this off-duty cop, this detective, who now, you know, goes and traces down, and by now it's the relief driver driving the cab, but it's the boyfriend of the girl that had been driving the cab. And he's denying everything. Well, they get the two of them in, and this detective's sweating him, and he's, you know, at one point he's on the phone talking to the district attorney, except that, you know, okay, I think we can get him 10 years for this, but, you know, the phone isn't actually plugged into anything. But they crack. And so they admit that they buried it up at Grandma's cottage in the woods. And by now, Bob has actually promised that there's also a $1,000 reward for returning the money. So they get the money, and he says, is it all here? And Bob says, well, you know, he said, it's $35,000, but I thought I had $45,000, but I'm not sure. He wasn't sure. So he winds up paying the cab drivers $1,000 finder's fee. He pays the detective $3,000 for helping him out. And then he gets back to Vegas, and he checks his notes, and he figures out that, yes, it was $45,000. So the girl had apparently ripped off $10,000 before she told her boyfriend about it and buried that money somewhere else.
Wow.
Wow. Taxi cab driving sounds to be a lucrative business.
Sometimes it is. Anyway, we welcome your questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them to me at RWM21. You can sign up for the show. It'll get delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube, or at my site, richardmunchkin.com, to see an archive of all the old shows. You can find that at bobdancer.com.
All right. Thank you, Jake Jacobs. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa. the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Views and opinions expressed on this program were those of the hosts and guests and did not necessarily reflect those of Vegas All Net Radio, its affiliates, or its parent company.